The next section in Dmitry Orlov's article, Post-Soviet Lessons for a Post-American Century, is Economic Collapse in the U.S. A spontaneous soft landing is unlikely in the U.S., where a large company can decide to shut its doors by executive decision, laying off personnel and auctioning off capital equipment and inventory, since in many cases the equipment is leased and the inventory is just in time and therefore very thin. A business can be made to evaporate virtually overnight. Since many executives may decide to cut their losses all at once, seeing the same economic projections and interpreting them similarly, the effect on communities can be utterly devastating. Most people in the U.S. cannot survive very long without an income. This may sound curious to some people. How can anyone, anywhere, survive without an income? Well, in post-collapse Russia, if you didn't pay rent or utilities, because no one else was paying them either, and if you grew or gathered a bit of your own food, and you had some friends and relatives to help you out, then an income was not a prerequisite for survival. Most people got by, somehow. But most people in the U.S., once their savings are depleted, would in due course be forced to live in their car, or in some secluded stretch of woods, in a tent, or under a tarp. There is currently no mechanism by which landlords can be made not to evict deadbeat tenants, or banks be prevailed upon not to foreclose on non-performing loans. A wholesale reintroduction of rent control seems politically unlikely. Once enough residential and commercial real estate becomes vacant, and law enforcement becomes lax or non-existent, squatting becomes a real possibility. Squatters usually find it hard to get mail and other services, but this is a very minor issue. More importantly, they can be easily dislodged again and again. The term loitering does not translate into Russian. The closest equivalent one can find is something along the lines of hanging around or wasting time in public. This is important because once nobody has a job to go to, the two choices they are presented with are sitting at home and, as it were, loitering. If loitering is illegal, then sitting at home becomes the only choice. The U.S. and the Soviet Union were at two extremes of a continuum between the public and the private. In the Soviet Union, most land was open to the public. Even apartments were often communal, meaning that the bedrooms were private, but the kitchen, bathroom, and hallway were common areas. In the U.S., most of the land is privately owned, some by people who put up signs threatening to shoot trespassers. Most public places are, in fact, private, marked customers only and no loitering. Where there are public parks, these are often closed at night, and anyone trying to spend a night there is likely to be told to move along by the police. After the collapse, Russia experienced a swelling of the ranks of people described by the acronym BOMZH, which is actually short for BOMZI, and stands for Persons Without a Definite Place of Residence or Employment. The BOMZIs, as they came to be called, often inhabited unused bits of the urban or rural landscape, where, with nobody to tell them to move along, were left largely in peace. Such an indefinite place of residence was often referred to as a BOMZATNIK. English badly needs a term for that. Perhaps we could call it a bum garden. It is as much a garden as an office park is a park. When the U.S. economy collapses, one would expect employment rates, and with them residency rates, to plummet. It's hard to estimate what percentage of the U.S. population would as a result become homeless, but it could be quite high, perhaps becoming so commonplace as to remove the stigma. In a country where most of the neighborhoods are structured so as to exclude people of inadequate means in order to preserve property values, it is not a pleasant place to be a bum. Then again, when property values start dropping to zero, we may find that some of the properties spontaneously rezone themselves into bum gardens with no political will or power anywhere to do anything about it. I do not mean to imply that Russian bums have a good time of it, but because most of the Russian population was able to keep their place of residence in spite of a collapsing economy, the percentage of bomjis in the general population never made it into the double digits. These most unfortunate cases led short, brutal lives, often in an alcoholic haze, and accounted for quite a lot of Russia's spike in post-collapse mortality. Some of them were refugees, Russians ethnically cleansed from the newly independent, suddenly nationalistic republics, who could not easily be reabsorbed into the Russian population due to Russia's chronic housing shortage. Russia's chronic housing shortage was partly caused by the spectacular decline of Russian agriculture, which caused people to migrate to the cities, and partly due simply to the inability of the government to put up buildings quickly enough. What the government wanted to put up was invariably an apartment building, 5 floors, 9 floors, and even some 14-floor towers. The buildings went up on vacant or vacated land, and were usually surrounded by a generous portion of wasteland, which in the smaller cities and towns, and in places where the soil is not frozen year-round, or covered with sulfur or soot from a nearby factory, was quickly converted into kitchen gardens. The quality of construction always looked a bit shabby, but has turned out to be surprisingly sound structurally and quite practical. Mostly it was reinforced concrete slab construction, with ceramic tile on the outside and hard plaster for insulation on the inside. It was cheap to heat and usually had heat, at least enough of it so that pipes wouldn't freeze, with the steam supplied by a gigantic central boiler that served an entire neighborhood. One often hears that the shabbiest of these Soviet-era apartment blocks, termed Khrushchevy, a melding of Khrushchev, who ordered them built, and Trushchevy, Russian for slums, are about to start collapsing. But they haven't done so yet. Yes, they are dank and dreary, and the apartments are cramped, and the walls are cracked, and the roof often leaks, and the hallways and stairwells are dark and smell of urine. But it's housing. Because apartments were so hard to come by, with waiting lists stretched out for decades, several generations generally lived together. This was often an unpleasant, stressful, and even traumatic way to live, but also very cheap. Grandparents often did a lot of the work of raising children while the parents worked. When the economy collapsed, it was often the grandparents who took to serious gardening and raised food during the summer months. Working-age people took to experimenting in the black market, with mixed results. Some would get lucky and strike it rich, while for others it was lean times. With enough people living together, these accidental disparities tended to even out, at least to some extent. A curious reversal took place. Whereas before the collapse, parents were often in a position to provide some financial help to their adult children, now the opposite is true. Older people who do not have children are much more likely to live in poverty than those who have children to support them. Once financial capital is wiped out, human capital becomes essential. A key difference between Russia and the U.S. is that Russians, like most people around the world, generally spend their entire lives living in one place, whereas Americans move around constantly. Russians generally know, or at least recognize, most of the people who surround them. When the economy collapses, everyone has to confront an unfamiliar situation. The Russians, at least, did not have to confront it in the company of complete strangers. On the other hand, Americans are far more likely than Russians to help out strangers, at least when they have something to spare. Another element that was helpful to Russians was a particular feature of Russian culture. Since money was not particularly useful in the Soviet-era economy and did not convey status or success, it was not particularly prized either and shared rather freely. Friends thought nothing of helping each other out in times of need. It was important that everyone had some, not that one had more than others. With the arrival of market economics, this cultural trait disappeared, but it persisted long enough to help people survive the transition. Another note on culture. Once the economy collapses, there is generally less to do, making it a good time for the naturally idle and a bad time for those predisposed to keeping busy. Soviet-era culture had room for two types of activity. Normal, which generally meant avoiding breaking a sweat, and heroic. Normal activity was expected, and there was never any reason to do it harder than expected. In fact, that sort of thing tended to be frowned upon by the collective, or the rank and file. Heroic activity was celebrated, but not necessarily rewarded financially. Russians tend to look in bemused puzzlement on the American compulsion to work hard and play hard. The term career was in the Soviet days a pejorative term, the attribute of a careerist, someone greedy, unscrupulous, and overly ambitious, also a pejorative term. Terms like success and achievement were very rarely applied on a personal level because they sounded overweening and pompous. They were reserved for bombastic public pronouncements about the great successes of the Soviet people. Not that positive personal characteristics did not exist. On a personal level, there was respect given to talent, professionalism, decency, sometimes even creativity. But a hard worker, to a Russian, sounded a lot like fool. A collapsing economy is especially hard on those who are accustomed to prompt, courteous service. In the Soviet Union, most official service was rude and slow and involved standing in long lines. Many of the products that were in short supply could not be obtained even in this manner and required something called blat, special unofficial access or favor. The exchange of personal favors was far more important to the actual functioning of the economy than the exchange of money. To Russians, blat is almost a sacred thing, a vital part of culture that holds society together. It is also the only part of the economy that is collapse-proof, and as such is a valuable cultural adaptation. Most Americans have heard of communism and automatically believe that it is an apt description of the Soviet system. Even though there was nothing particularly communal about a welfare state and a vast industrial empire run by an elitist central planning bureaucracy. But very few of them have ever heard of the real operative ism that dominated Soviet life, Dauphinism, which can be loosely translated as not giving a rat's ass. A lot of people, more and more during the stagnation period of the 1980s, felt nothing but contempt for the system. Did what little they had to do get by? Night watchman and furnace stoker were favorite jobs among the highly educated, and got all their pleasure from their friends, from their reading, or from nature. This sort of disposition may seem like a cop-out, but when there is a collapse on the horizon, it works as psychological insurance. Instead of going through the agonizing process of losing and rediscovering one's identity in a post-collapse environment, one could simply sit back and watch events unfold. If you are currently a mover and shaker of things or people or whatever, then collapse will surely come as a shock to you. And it will take you a long time, perhaps forever, to find more things to move and shake to your satisfaction. However, if your current occupation is as a keen observer of grass and trees, then post-collapse, you could take on something else that's useful, such as dismantling useless things. The ability to stop and smell the roses, to let it all go, to refuse to harbor regrets or nurture grievances, to confine one's serious attention only to that which is immediately necessary, and not to worry too much about the rest, is perhaps the one most critical to post-collapse survival. The most psychologically devastated are usually the middle-aged breadwinners who, once they are no longer gainfully employed, feel completely lost. Detachment and indifference can be most healing, provided they do not become morbid. It is good to take your sentimental nostalgia for what once was, is, and will soon no longer be up front and get it over with. And I'm reading from Post-Soviet Lessons for a Post-American Century by Dmitry Orlov. Russia's post-collapse economy was for a time dominated by one type of wholesale business, asset stripping. To put it in an American setting, suppose you have title or otherwise unhindered access to an entire suburban subdivision which is no longer accessible by transportation, either public or private, too far to reach by bicycle, and is generally no longer suitable for its intended purpose of housing and accumulating equity for fully employed commuters who shop at the now defunct nearby mall. After all the mortgages are foreclosed and the properties repossessed, what more is there to do except board it all up and let it rot? Well, what has been developed can just as easily be undeveloped. What you do is strip it of anything valuable or reusable and either sell or stockpile the materials. Pull the copper out of the streets and the walls. Haul away the curbstones and the utility poles. Take down the vinyl siding. Yank out the fiberglass insulation. The sinks and windows can surely find a new use somewhere else, especially if no new ones are being made. Having bits of the landscape disappear can be a rude surprise. One summer I arrived in St. Petersburg and found that a new scourge had descended on the land while I was gone. A lot of manhole covers were mysteriously missing. Nobody knew where they went or who profited from their removal. One guess was that the municipal workers who hadn't been paid in months took them home with them to be returned once they got paid. They did eventually reappear, so there may be some merit to this theory. With the gaping manholes positioned throughout the city like so many anteater traps for cars, you had the choice of driving either very slowly and carefully or very fast and betting your life on the proper functioning of the shock absorbers. Post-collapse Russia's housing stock stayed largely intact, but an orgy of asset stripping of a different kind took place. Not just leftover inventory, but entire factories were stripped down and exported. What went on in Russia under the guise of privatization is a subject for a different article, but whether it's called privatization or liquidation or theft doesn't matter. Those with title to something worthless will find a way to extract value from it, making it even more worthless. An abandoned suburban subdivision might be worthless as housing, but valuable as a dump site for toxic waste. Just because the economy is going to collapse in the most oil-addicted country on earth doesn't necessarily mean that things will be just as bad everywhere else. As the Soviet example shows, if the entire country is for sale, buyers will materialize out of nowhere, crate it up, and haul it away. They will export everything. Furnishings, equipment, works of art, antiques. The last remnant of industrial activity is usually the scrap iron business. There seems to be no limit to the amount of iron that can be extracted from a mature post-industrial state. The dismal state of Soviet agriculture turned out to be paradoxically beneficial in fostering a kitchen garden economy, which helped Russians to survive the collapse. At one point, it became informally known that 10% of the farmland, the part allocated to private plots, was being used to produce 90% of the food. Beyond underscoring the gross inadequacies of Soviet-style command-and-control industrial agriculture, it is indicative of a general fact. Agriculture is far more efficient when it is carried out on a small scale using manual labor. Russians always grew some of their own food, and the scarcity of high-quality produce in the government stores kept the kitchen garden tradition going even during the more prosperous times of the 60s and 70s. After the collapse, these kitchen gardens turned out to be lifesavers. What many Russians practiced, either through tradition or by trial and error or sheer laziness, was in some ways akin to the new organic farming and permaculture techniques. Many productive plots in Russia look like a riot of herbs, vegetables, and flowers growing in wild profusion. Forests in Russia have always been used as an important source of additional food. Russians recognize and eat just about every edible mushroom variety and all of the edible berries. During the peak mushroom season, which is generally in the fall, forests are overrun with mushroom pickers. The mushrooms are either pickled or dried and stored, and often last throughout the winter. A rather striking similarity between Russians and Americans is their propensity to self-medicate. While the Russian has traditionally been single-heartedly dedicated to the pursuit of vodka, the American is more likely than not to have also tried cannabis. Cocaine has also had a big effect on American culture, as have opiates. There are differences as well. The Russian is somewhat less likely to drink alone, or to be apprehended for drinking or being drunk in public. To a Russian, being drunk is almost a sacred rite. To an American, it is a guilty pleasure. Many of the unhappier Americans are forced by their circumstances to drink and drive. This does not make them, nor the other drivers, nor the pedestrians, should any still exist, any happier. The Russian can get furiously drunk in public, stagger about singing patriotic songs, fall into a snowbank, and either freeze to death or be carted off to a drunk tank. All this produces little or no remorse in him. Based on my reading of H.L. Mencken, America was also once upon a time a land of happy drunks, where a whiskey bottle would be passed around the courtroom at the start of the proceedings, and where a drunken jury would later render a drunken verdict. But prohibition ruined all that. Russia's prohibition lasted only a few short years, while Gorbachev tried to save the nation from itself and failed miserably. When the economy collapses, hard-drinking people everywhere find all the more reason to get drunk, but much less wherewithal with which to procure drink. In Russia, innovative market-based solutions were quickly improvised, which it was my privilege to observe. It was summer, and I was on a local electric train heading out of St. Petersburg. It was packed, so I stood in the vestibule of the car and observed rainbows through the missing window pane. Soon, activity within the vestibule caught my attention. At each stop, grannies with jugs of moonshine would approach the car door and offer a sniff to the eager customers waiting inside. Price and quality were quickly discussed, and agreed-upon quantity was dispensed in exchange for a fistful of notes, jug to mug, and the train moved on. It was a tense atmosphere because along with the paying customers there came many others who were simply along for the ride, but expected their fair share nevertheless. I was forced to make a hasty exit and jam myself into the salon because the freeloaders thought I was taking up valuable freeloading space. There might be a few moonshine makers left in rural parts of the United States, but most of the country seems to be addicted to cans and bottles of beer, or jugs, plastic or glass, of liquor. When this source dries up due to problems with interstate trucking, local breweries will no doubt continue to operate and even expand production to cope with both old and new demand, but there will still be plenty of room for improvisation. I would also expect cannabis to become even more widespread. It makes people less prone to violence than liquor, which is good, but it also stimulates their appetite, which is bad if there isn't a lot of food. Still, it is much cheaper to produce than alcohol, which requires either grain or natural gas and complicated chemistry. In all, I expect drugs and alcohol to become one of the largest short-term post-collapse entrepreneurial opportunities in the United States, along with asset stripping and security. I'm reading Post-Soviet Lessons for the Post-American Century by Dmitry Orlov. We'll take a music break and return for the conclusion.
Tuck in your daughter, turn out the light. Bombs are dropping in the desert tonight. Warm up the car on a cold night. Bombs dropping in the desert. Gas station up by the blinking light. Bombs are dropping in the desert tonight. Top off the tank cause the price is right. Bombs dropping in the desert. To a party on a Saturday night. Bombs are dropping in the desert tonight. Corona with a lime and an Amstel Light. Bombs are dropping in the desert. Knows how to pick a fight. Bombs are dropping in the desert tonight. The radio man from the radical right says bombs away in the desert. Frostbite. Bombs are dropping in the desert tonight. March in the rain and the cold in the ice. Stop the bombing in the desert.
The next section of Dmitry Orlov's article is titled Loss of Normalcy. An early victim of collapse is a sense of normalcy. People are initially shocked to find that it's missing, but quickly forget that such a thing ever existed, except for the odd vague tinge of nostalgia. Normalcy is not exactly normal. In an industrial economy, the sense of normalcy is an artificial, manufactured item. We may be hurtling towards environmental doom, and thankfully never quite get there because of resource depletion. But in the meantime, the lights are on, there is traffic on the streets, and even if the lights go out for a while due to a blackout, they will be back in due course and the shops will reopen. Business as usual will resume. The sumptuous buffet lunch will be served on time so that the assembled luminaries can resume discussion of measured steps we all need to take to avert a certain disaster. The lunch is not served. Then the lights go out. At some point, somebody calls the whole thing a farce, and the luminaries adjourn forever. In Russia, normalcy broke down in a series of steps. First, people stopped being afraid to speak their mind. Then, they stopped taking the authorities seriously. Lastly, the authorities stopped taking each other seriously. In the final act, Yeltsin got up on a tank and spoke the words, "Former Soviet Union." In the Soviet Union, as this thing called normalcy wore thin due to the stalemate in Afghanistan, the Chernobyl disaster, and the general economic stagnation, it continued to be enforced through careful management of mass media well into the period known as Glasnost. In the United States, as the economy fails to create enough jobs for several years in a row, and the entire economy tilts toward bankruptcy, business as usual continues to be a top-selling product, or so we are led to believe. American normalcy circa 2005 seems as impregnable as Soviet normalcy circa 1985 once seemed. If there is a difference between the Soviet and the American approaches to maintaining a sense of normalcy, it is this. The Soviets tried to maintain it by force, while the Americans' superior approach is to maintain theirs through fear. You tend to feel more normal if you fear falling off your perch and cling to it for dear life than if somebody nails your feet to it. More to the point, in a consumer society, anything that puts people off their shopping is dangerously disruptive, and all consumers sense this. Any expression of the truth about our lack of prospects for continued existence as a highly developed, prosperous industrial society is disruptive to the consumerist collective unconscious. There is a herd instinct to reject it, and it therefore fails, not through any overt action, but by failing to turn a profit because it is unpopular. In spite of this small difference in how normalcy is or was enforced, it was and is being brought down in the late Soviet Union as in the contemporary United States through almost identical means, though with different technology. In the Soviet Union, there was something called samizdat, or self-publishing. With the help of manual typewriters and carbon paper, Russian dissidents managed to circulate enough material to neutralize the effects of enforced normalcy. In contemporary United States, we have websites and bloggers. Different technology, same difference. These are writings for which enforced normalcy is no longer the norm. The norm is the truth, or at least someone's earnest approximation of it. So what has become of these Soviet mavericks, some of whom foretold the coming collapse with some accuracy? To be brief, they faded from view. Both tragically and ironically, those who became experts in explaining the faults of the system and in predicting the course of its demise are very much part of the system. When the system disappears, so does their area of expertise and their audience. People stop intellectualizing their predicament and start trying to escape it, through drink or drugs or creativity or cunning, but they have no time for pondering the larger context. Security in post-collapse Soviet Union was, shall we say, lax. I came through unscathed, but I know quite a few people who did not. A childhood friend of mine and her son were killed in their apartment over the measly sum of $100. An elderly lady I know was knocked out and had her jaw broken by a burglar who waited outside her door for her to come home, assaulted her, took her keys, and looted her place. There is an infinite supply of stories of this sort. Empires are held together through violence or the threat of violence. Both the U.S. and Russia were and are serviced by a legion of servants whose expertise is in using violence. Soldiers, policemen, prison wardens, and private security consultants. Both countries have a surplus of battle-hardened men who have killed, who are psychologically damaged by the experience, and have no qualms about taking human life. In both countries, there are many, many people whose stock in trade is their use of violence, in offense or defense. No matter what else happens, they will be employed or self-employed, preferably the former. In a post-collapse situation, all of these violent men automatically fall into the general category of private security consultants. They have a way of creating enough work to keep their entire tribe busy. If you don't hire them, they will still do the work, but against you rather than for you. Rackets of various sizes and shapes proliferate, and if you have some property to protect or wish to get something done, a great deal of your time and energy become absorbed by keeping your private security organization happy and effective. To round out the violent part of the population, there are also plenty of criminals. As their sentences expire, or as jail overcrowding and lack of resources force the authorities to grant amnesties, they are released into the wild and return to a life of violent crime. But now there is nobody to lock them up again because the machinery of law enforcement is broken down due to lack of funds. This further exacerbates the need for private security and puts those who cannot afford it at additional risk. There's a continuum of sorts between those who can provide security and mere thugs. Those who can provide security also tend to know how to either employ or otherwise dispose of mere thugs. Thus, from the point of view of an uneducated security consumer, it is very important to work with an organization rather than with individuals. The need for security is huge, with a large number of desperate people about. Anything that is not watched will be stolen. The scope of security-related activities is also huge, from sleepless grannies who sit and watch over the cucumber patch, to bicycle parking lot attendants, to house sitters, all the way to armed convoys and snipers on rooftops. As the government, with its policing and law enforcement functions, atrophies, private improvised security measures cover the security gap it leaves behind. In Russia, there was a period of years during which the police was basically not functioning. They had no equipment, no budget, and their salaries were not sufficient for survival. Murders went unsolved, muggings and burglaries were not even investigated. The police could only survive through graft. There was a substantial amount of melding between the police and organized crime. As the economy came back, it all got sorted out to some extent. Where there is no reason to expect the economy to ever come back, one must learn how to make strange new friends and keep them for life. Before, during, and immediately after the Soviet collapse, there was a great deal of political activity by groups we might regard as progressive, liberal, environmentalist, pro-democracy reformers. These grew out of the dissident movements of the Soviet era and made quite a significant impact for a time. A decade later, democracy and liberalism are generally considered dirty words in Russia, commonly associated with exploitation of Russia by foreigners and other rot. The Russian state is centrist with authoritarian tendencies. Most Russians dislike and distrust their government, but are afraid of weakness and want a strong hand at the helm. It is easy to see why political idealism fails to thrive in the murky post-collapse political environment. There is a strong pull to the right by nationalists who want to find scapegoats, inevitably foreigners and ethnic minorities. A strong pull to the center by members of the ancient regime trying to hold on to remnants of their power. And a great upwelling of indecision, confusion, and inconclusive debate on the left by those trying to do good and failing to do anything. Sometimes the liberals get a chance to try an experiment or two. Yegor Gaidar got to try some liberal economic reforms under Yeltsin. He is a tragic comic figure, and many Russians now cringe when remembering his efforts, and to be fair, we don't even know how helpful or damaging his reforms might have been, since most of them were never implemented. The liberals, reformists, and progressives in the United States, whether self-styled or so labeled, have had a hard time implementing their agenda. Even their few hard-won victories, such as Social Security, may get dismantled. Even when they manage to elect a president more to their liking, the effects were, by Western standards, reactionary. There was a Carter Doctrine, according to which the United States will protect its access to oil by military aggression if necessary. There was also Clinton's welfare reform, which forced single mothers to work menial jobs while placing their children in substandard daycare. People in the United States have a broadly similar attitude toward politics with people in the Soviet Union. In the U.S., this is often referred to as voter apathy, but it might be more accurately described as non-voter indifference. The Soviet Union had a single, entrenched, systemically corrupt political party, which held a monopoly on power. The U.S. has two entrenched, systemically corrupt political parties, whose positions are often indistinguishable, and which together hold a monopoly on power. In either case, there is or was a single governing elite, but in the United States it organized itself into opposing teams to make its stranglehold on power seem more sportsmanlike. In the U.S., there is an industry of political commentators and pundits which is devoted to inflaming political passions as much as possible, especially before elections. This is similar to what sports writers and commentators do to draw attention to their game. It seems that the main force behind political discourse in the U.S. is boredom. One can chat about the weather, one's job, one's mortgage, and how it relates to current and projected property values, cars and the traffic situation, sports, and far behind sports, politics. In an effort to make people pay attention, most of the issues trotted out before the electorate pertain to reproduction, abortion, birth control, stem cell research, and similar bits of social policy are bandied about rather than settled, simply because they get good ratings. Boring but vitally important strategic issues such as sustainable development, environmental protection, and energy policy are studiously avoided. Although people often bemoan political apathy as if it were a grave social ill, it seems to me that this is just as it should be. Why should essentially powerless people want to engage in a humiliating farce designed to demonstrate the legitimacy of those who wield the power? In Soviet-era Russia, intelligent people did their best to ignore the communists. Paying attention to them, whether through criticism or praise, would only serve to give them comfort and encouragement, making them feel as if they mattered. Why should Americans want to act any differently with regard to the Republicans and the Democrats? For love of donkeys and elephants? As I mentioned before, crisis mitigating agendas for us to implement, whether they involve wars over access to resources, nuclear plant construction, wind farms, or hydrogen dreams, are not likely to be implemented, because this we entity will no longer be functional. If we are not likely to be able to implement our agenda prior to the collapse, then whatever is left of us is even less likely to do so afterward. Thus, there is little reason to organize politically in order to try to do good. But if you want to prepare to take advantage of a bad situation, well, that's a different story. And I'm reading from Post-Soviet Lessons for a Post-American Century by Dmitry Orlov. Politics has great potential for making a bad situation worse. It can cause war, ethnic cleansing, and genocide. Whenever people gather into political organizations, whether voluntarily or forcibly, it is a sign of trouble. I was at the annual meeting of my community garden recently, and among the generally placid and shy group of gardeners, there were a couple of self-styled activists. Before too long, one of these was raising the question of expelling people. People who don't show up for annual meetings and don't sign up to do cleaning and composting and so on. Why are they allowed to hold on to their plots? Well, some of the rogue elements the activist was referring to consisted of elderly Russians who, due to their extensive experience with such things during the Soviet times, are exceedingly unlikely to ever be compelled to take part in communal labor or sit through meetings with the collective. Frankly, they would prefer death, but they also love to garden. The reason the element is allowed to exist in this particular community garden is because the woman who runs the place allows them to hold on to their plots. It is her decision. She exercises leadership, and she does not engage in politics. She makes the garden function and allows the activists to make their noise once a year with no ill effects. But if the situation were to change and the kitchen garden suddenly became a source of sustenance rather than a hobby, how long would it take before the activist element would start demanding more power and asserting its authority? Leadership is certainly a helpful quality in a crisis, which is a particularly bad time for lengthy deliberations and debates. In any situation, some people are better equipped to handle it than others, and can help others by giving them directions. They naturally accumulate a certain amount of power for themselves, and this is fine as long as enough people benefit from it, and as long as nobody is harmed or oppressed. Such people often spontaneously emerge in a crisis. An equally useful quality in a crisis is apathy. The Russian people are exceptionally patient. Even in the worst of post-collapse times, they did not riot, and there were no significant protests. They coped as best they could. The safest group of people to be with in a crisis is one that does not share strong ideological convictions, is not easily swayed by argument, and does not possess an overdeveloped, exclusive sense of identity. Clueless busybodies who feel that we must do something and can be spun around by any half-wit demagogue are bad enough. But the most dangerous group, and the one to watch out for and run from, is a group of political activists resolved to organize and promote some program or other. Even if the program is benign, and even if it is beneficial, the politicized approach to solving it might not be. As the saying goes, revolutions eat their children, and then they turn on everyone else. The life of a refugee is a form of survival. Staying and fighting an organized mob generally isn't. The Balkans are the post-collapse nightmare everyone is familiar with. Within the former Soviet Union, Georgia is the prime example of nationalist politics pursued to the point of national disintegration. After winning its independence, Georgia went through a paroxysm of nationalist fervor, resulting in a somewhat smaller, slightly less populous, permanently defunct state, with widespread poverty, a large refugee population, and two former provinces stuck in permanent political limbo because apparently the world has lost its ability to redraw political boundaries. In its current form, it is politically and militarily a client of Washington, treasured only as a pipeline route for Caspian oil. Its major trading partner and energy supplier is the Russian Federation. The U.S. is much more like the Balkans than like Russia, which is inhabited by a fairly homogeneous Caucasian-Asian population. The U.S. is very much segregated, usually by race, often by ethnicity, and always by income level. During prosperous times, it is kept relatively calm by keeping a percentage of people in jail that has set an all-time world record. During less prosperous times, it is at big risk of political explosion. Multi-ethnic societies are fragile and unstable. When they fall apart or explode, everyone loses. And I'm reading from Post-Soviet Lessons in a Post-American Century by Dmitry Orlov. And the next section, Collapse in the U.S. In the U.S., there appear to be few ways to make the collapse scenario work out smoothly for oneself and one's family. The whole place seems too far gone in a particular, unsustainable direction. It is a real creative challenge, and we should be giving it a lot of serious thought. Suppose you live in a big city, in an apartment or a condo. You depend on municipal services for survival. A week without electricity or heat or water or gas or garbage removal spells extreme discomfort. Any two of these is a calamity. Any three is a disaster. Food comes from the supermarket, with help from the cash machine or the credit card slot at the checkout station. Clean clothes come from the laundromat, which requires electricity, water, and natural gas. Once all the businesses have shut down and your apartment is cold, dark, smells like garbage because it isn't being collected, and like excrement because the toilet doesn't flush, perhaps it is time to go camping and explore the great outdoors. So let's consider the countryside. Suppose that you own a homestead and have a tiny mortgage that shrivels to next to nothing after a good bout of inflation, or that you own it free and clear. If it's in a developed suburban subdivision, there will still be problems with taxes, code enforcement, strangers from outer space living next door, and other boondoggles, which could get worse as conditions deteriorate. Distressed municipalities may at first attempt to jack up rates to cover the costs instead of simply closing up shop. In a misguided effort to save property values, they may also attempt to enforce codes against such necessities as compost heaps, outhouses, chicken coops, and crops planted on your front lawn. Keep in mind also that the pesticides and herbicides lavished on lawns and golf courses leave toxic residues. Perhaps the best thing to do with suburbia is to abandon it altogether. A small farm offers somewhat better possibilities for farming, but most farms in the U.S. are mortgaged to the hilt, and most land that has been under intensive cultivation has been mercilessly bombarded with chemical fertilizers, herbicides, and insecticides, making it an unhealthy place, inhabited by men with tiny sperm counts. Small farms tend to be lonely places, and many without access to diesel or gasoline would become dangerously remote. You will need neighbors to barter with to help you and to keep you company. Even a small farm is probably overkill in terms of the amount of farmland available, because without the ability to get crops to market or a functioning cash economy to sell them in, there is no reason to grow a large surplus of food. Tens of acres are a waste when all you need is a few thousand square feet. Many Russian families managed to survive with the help of a standard garden plot of one sotka, which is 100 square meters, or if you prefer, 1,076 square feet. What is needed, of course, is a small town or a village. A relatively small, relatively dense settlement, with about an acre of farmland for every 30 or so people, and with zoning regulations designed for fair use and sustainability, not opportunities for capital investment, growth, property values, or other sorts of development. Further, it would have to be a place where people know each other and are willing to help each other, a real community. There may still be a few hundred communities like that tucked away here and there in the poorer counties in the United States, but there are not enough of them, and most of them are too poor to absorb a significant population of economic migrants. And I'm reading from Post-Soviet Lessons for a Post-American Century. Often when people hear about the possibility of economic collapse, they wonder, let's suppose that the U.S. economy is going to collapse soon. Why is it even worth thinking about if there is nothing I can do about it? Well, I'm not a professional investment advisor, so I risk nothing by making some suggestions for how one can collapse-proof one's investment portfolio. The nuclear scare gave rise to the archetype of the American survivalist, holed up in the hills with a bomb shelter, a fantastic number of tins of Spam, and an assortment of guns and plentiful ammunition with which to fight off neighbors from further downhill, or perhaps just to shoot beer cans when the neighbors come over for beer and spamwiches, and, of course, an American flag. This sort of survivalism is about as good as burning yourself alive, I suppose. The idea of stockpiling is not altogether bad, though. Stockpiling food is, of course, a rotten idea, literally. But certain manufactured items are certainly worth considering. Suppose you have a retirement account or some mutual funds. And suppose you feel reasonably certain that by the time you are scheduled to retire, it won't be enough to buy a cup of coffee. And suppose you realize that you can currently buy a lot of good stuff that has a long shelf life and will be needed and valuable far into the future. And suppose that you have a small amount of storage space, a few hundred square feet. Now, what are you going to do? Sit by and watch your savings evaporate? Or take the tax hit and invest in things that are not composed of vapor? Once the cash machines are out of cash, the stock ticker stops ticking, and the retail chain breaks down, people will still have basic needs. There will be flea markets and private barter arrangements to serve these needs, using whatever local token of exchange is available. Bundles of $100 bills, bits of gold chain, packs of cigarettes, or what have you. It's not a bad idea to own a few of everything you will need, but you should invest in things you will be able to trade for things you will need. Think of consumer necessities that require high technology and have a long shelf life. Here are some suggestions to get you started. Drugs, over-the-counter and prescription. Razor blades. Condoms. Rechargeable batteries and solar chargers are sure to become a prized item. Toiletries, such as good soap, will be luxury items. Fill some shipping containers, nitrogen-pack them so that nothing rusts or rots, and store them somewhere. After the Soviet collapse, there swiftly appeared a category of itinerant merchants who provided people with access to imported products. To procure their wares, these people had to travel abroad, to Poland, to China, to Turkey, on trains, carrying goods back and forth in their baggage. They would exchange a suitcase of Russian-made watches for a suitcase of other more useful consumer products, such as shampoo or razor blades. They would have to grease the palms of officials along their route and were often robbed. There was a period of time when these people, called Chelnoki, which is Russian for shuttles, were the only source of consumer products. The products were often factory rejects, damaged or past their sell-by date, but this did not make them any less valuable. Based on their example, it is possible to predict which items will be in high demand and to stockpile these items ahead of time as a hedge against economic collapse. Note that the Chelnoki had intact economies to trade with, accessible by train, while this is not guaranteed to be the case in the U.S. A stockpile of this sort in a walkable, socially stable place where you know everybody, where you have some close friends and some family, where you own your own shelter and some land free and clear, where you can grow most of your own food and barter for the rest, should enable you to survive economic collapse without too much trouble. And who knows? And who knows, maybe you'll even find happiness there. Although the basic and obvious conclusion is that the United States is worse prepared for economic collapse than Russia was, and we will have a harder time than Russia had, there are some cultural facets to the United States that are not entirely unhelpful. To close on an optimistic note, I will mention three of these. Firstly, and perhaps most surprisingly, Americans make better communists than Russians ever did or cared to try. They excel at communal living with plenty of good, stable roommate situations, which compensate for their weak, alienated, or non-existent families. These roommate situations can be used as a template and scaled up to make village-sized, self-organized communities. Big households that pool their resources make a lot more sense in an unstable, resource-scarce environment than the individualistic approach. Without a functioning economy, a household that consists of a single individual or a nuclear family ceases to be viable, and people are forced to live in ever larger households, from roommate situations to taking lodgers to doubling up to forming villages. Where any Russian would cringe at such an idea because it stirs the still fresh memories of the failed Soviet experiment at collectivization and forced communal living, many Americans are adept at making fast friends and getting along, and generally seem to possess an untapped reserve of gregariousness, community spirit, and civic-minded idealism. Secondly, there is a layer of basic decency and niceness to at least some parts of American society, which has been all but destroyed in Russia over the course of Soviet history. There is an altruistic impulse to help strangers and pride in being helpful to others. In many ways, Americans are culturally homogeneous, and the biggest interpersonal barrier between them is the fear and alienation fostered by their racially and economically segregated living conditions. And lastly, hidden behind the tawdry veneer of patriotic bumper stickers and flags, there is an undercurrent of quiet national pride, which, if engaged, can produce high morale and results. Americans are not yet willing to simply succumb to circumstances, because many of them lack a good understanding of their national predicament. Their efforts to mitigate it may turn out to be in vain. But they are virtually guaranteed to make a valiant effort, for this is, after all, America. I've been reading Post-Soviet Lessons for the Post-American Century, an article by Dmitry Orlov, originally published earlier this year in From the Wilderness at fromthewilderness.com. The music featured in the program was by Pierce Woodward, and our theme music on Welcome Guest is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. You can download this and previous episodes at our website on welcomeguests.org.